And for our final presentation this morning, we have Glenn Harris with us. He's going to talk on the topic of putting the 4 R's of nutrient management into practice in the Southeast.
Yep. All right, the one you've been looking forward to, one right before lunch. I'm going to kind of jump right into it because I got a lot of slides to cover. And if you have any questions along the way, feel free to interrupt because we might not end up with a lot of time at the end. But my topic today, it's kind of interesting. Hopefully you've heard of this before. The fertilizer industry came out with this kind of concept promotion years ago about the 4 R's. They had this logo, which is pretty complicated. A lot of buzzwords on there, including the three around the outside of the circle. Looked like sustainable ag to me. But really the focus is in the center of the circle, and if you look at it, you got the 4 R's, which, and I go in this order usually, rate, source, time, and placement. And if you're like me, when I first saw this, I said, how do you get 4 R's? I see an R, an S, a T, and a P, right? But as you all know, the answer to that question is you're supposed to have the right rate, the right source, the right time, and the right placement. I usually joke around and wonder about how many beers that guy had before he came up with this. But you know, really, and again, I kind of, when I first saw it, I was like, okay, yeah, that's good. But really, after a few years went by, it's really interesting. If I look at everything I do as an extension specialist in an applied research program, it fits into this when I'm looking at soils and fertilizer research. So what I wanted to do today is share with you some examples from all the data I'll show you is from projects I've done with my crew. We're not going to spend a lot of time in the details. I really just want to show these as examples of some of the things that all come back to this concept of having the right rate, source, time, and placement as fertilization. I thought it would be helpful. This is a different audience for me. I don't know a lot of you. I think we're scattered all over the country, so I thought real quickly I would tell you I was born and raised in southern New Jersey, and yes, there is agriculture in southern New Jersey. My family didn't have a farm, but I consider having a farm background, working on farms growing up. I did my degrees at Penn State, Michigan State, and I've been at the University of Georgia in Tifton since 1994 as an extension agronomist for soils and fertilizers. Again, I do applied research, and we started a teaching program in 2003, so also teach. And the crops I deal with mostly are cotton, peanuts, corn, and soybean in that order. If you look around, I also have some international experience. If you look at the global soils, I've been involved with projects on peanut in Guyana, South America. I've done some work with both cotton and peanuts on a number of trips to Australia, including the sabbatical. I've been to China and also worked with peanuts in South Africa. And recently just got back from a trip to the Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa involving the corn production. But if you zoom back in to look at the soils from the states, obviously they're very different. So things we do, fertilization and how we'll look at these 4 R's could be very different. But I'm solid in the coastal plain right above that number 7 is where we're going to focus on today. With what I'm bringing to you. And really, Georgia from top to bottom is very different when you look at it. You go from mountain valley soils through the Piedmont, what most people think about red Georgia clay, to the Sand Ridge, and then down in the coastal plain in the southern part of the state, and including the Flatwood region over by the coast, which is technically coastal plain, but has a high water table during the winter. And again, with CCA training, it's never bad to go back to some basics. So just again, to set you where we are, we're in the sand corner of this triangle, of the textural triangle. A lot of our topsoils are loamy sands, maybe sandy loams, and even we got some, sure enough, what we call by God sands. And CECs are low. So this is a slide I use for class and try to emphasize that in this grand scheme is for cation exchange capacity. This is from the old PPI soil fertility manual. We're definitely on the side with the sand, and CEC's down around 5, not like 25 like you'd find in the Midwest or whatever. So in general, soils I work with in South Georgia and really a lot of the coastal plain soils are, you know, they're ultisols, so they're highly weathered, poorly buffered, acid, low in fertility, and low organic matter. You look at that and say, how do you even grow anything? right? But, you know, of course, with lime, fertilizer, irrigation, which we have a lot of in Georgia, in the coastal plain region, and organic matter is probably the last one we really need to do a better job with some of these cover crops, like from like talking about in other talks this morning. But we can make good yields if we manage these soils. So starting, and again, you can take the four R's in any order you want, but I really think about rate first, because I think that's what we mostly focus on. And in fact, I think we kind of have a tendency to not think about as much as the other three R's. You know, just tell me how much I need. I'll go down to the store and buy whatever I need or whatever. But rate needs to be based on soil testing, of course. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on the slide, but this is an example of a report form that would come from Georgia for a routine soil test. We use malic one extractant at this point. And this is for cotton. This would be fairly maybe typical that you would see. You notice we routinely test for two primary nutrients, two secondary, two micronutrients, and pH. We actually changed how we do pH. We used to measure it in water. Now we measure it in dilute salt. So you get the levels for those, and then on the bottom, you get recommendations for those, plus you add in nitrogen, sulfur, and boron. We do not test for those in our soils because we just assume they're very highly mobile in our soils, and all the recommendations are based on field research, but we don't actually test for nitrogen, sulfur, and boron. Some of the private labs actually will test for things like sulfur, but we don't at this point. Also, the other thing about rate, you got to factor in yield goal. If you notice up in the top left corner on the cotton, it says for 1,500 pound. That's three bale cotton. That's pretty good cotton. When I first got to Georgia 22 years ago, that was kind of something really to shoot for. Now it's more common. So we actually changed our yield goal concept to put a little more fertilizer, N, P, and K, based on research, for higher yield goals. And what's interesting is my colleagues in Alabama, or at least one of my colleagues in Alabama, doesn't really agree with that concept of fertilizing the yield goal. And we argue all the time, but what it basically comes back to, they don't have as much irrigation. They don't have a lot of yield potential. So I say, well, yeah, you don't need to fertilize for yield goal. You know, it's all low. So that sounds terrible, but it's the truth. And he understands that too. But he can't understand why Georgia would fertilize for yield goal. Of course, he's never lived there. So that was cotton. Corn even gets more interesting. Because our base rate for yield goal, when we're looking at rates for corn, is 150 bushel per acre. And we got farmers routinely trying to push for 250, 300. We have might have seen in the farm magazines, a guy making 500 bushel corn. Not really sure exactly how much fertilizer he uses. That's a whole another story. But the interesting part is this, is we've always had this recommendation on our books to take that 150 bushel yield goal and then bump it up for higher yield goals. And now we actually have it where the farmers can you know, when they submit their sample, say whether they're shooting for 150, 200, 250, or 300. And it gets kind of interesting. I just kind of made this quick chart for 100, those yield goals, for about three situations. I didn't put them all there, but if you were low in P and K, all the way up to high and high. And it's very interesting if you look at it. So worst case scenario, or the lowest amount recommended, you notice we recommend 1.2 pounds of N per bushel across the board for those yield goals for nitrogen. And then if you look at the P and K, if you had high levels of P and K in your soil and only going for 150 bushel, your recommendation is 180, 70, 70. But if you are shooting for 300 bushel and you're low in P and K to start with, it's all the way up to 360, 200, 280. I mean, that's a huge difference, right? So obviously the question becomes, you know, let's test this. You can't test all situations, but test this and see what happens. So that's what I started doing in 2013. And I basically, now this is N, P, and K. I didn't single out one of the other nutrients, but I tested for N, P, and K, recommended for 150, 200, 250, and 300. And I've been accused of actually making up this data, but I guarantee you this is real data. This is what happened. Because I was almost spot on from the beginning. You know, with starter only made 64 bushel, but 150, just above 150, 200, 222, 250, made 254, and I didn't quite make 300. So I really don't think it's nutrients that's holding me back. I think it's something else, population, variety, row spacing, sunlight, one of the other limiting factors in Liebig's law of the minimum, okay? But very interesting. And so that worked out well in 2013. I repeated the study in 2014. I got a little kind of cocky and went for 350 bushel. But then look what happened. I didn't even make 200 when I fertilized for 200 and I plateaued. What happened in that year? We had bad disease rust problems and I did not have a way to spray my small research plots with fungicide. And that's basically what happened. So that was the limiting factor that year for sure. So I went ahead and did it again in 2015, came out a little more like that first year, and you can see I still didn't quite make 300, but so that the concept seems to work, and we all know that. Corn responds to fertility like that. The other thing I like to point out is this land just might have, that might be the potential for this type of land. It's very sandy, this particular site. Have good water, but the soil's not as good. I have other sites where the soil's better, but the water's not as good. If I could put those together, I probably would have made 300. But the other thing I like to point out, too, is when you think about this, and the fertilizer industry likes me to point this out, is that this land obviously has the potential to make 270, at least bushel. If you only fertilize for 150, that's all you're going to get. So you're leaving corn on the table, so to speak. So it's all how you look at it. That's the main thing I wanted to share with you. Got some other examples of rate. We looked at phosphorus on corn. We don't have a lot of problems with phosphorus in the coastal plain of Georgia. We have a lot of chicken litter. I was surprised we got some response, but not near as dramatic as like the nitrogen. I was able to find a low soil test phosphorus location on experiment station to do this work. So you see the response there. So that's testing rate. Peanut varieties is another. I don't know how much you know about peanuts, but when we shifted from a small seeded variety to growing a whole another variety, it was a lot larger seeded. We thought we needed more calcium. And so a colleague of mine, Julie Howe in Auburn, and I, we got over like a four-year period, had 14 site years of data, dry land and irrigated, on calcium on small and large seeded. Everybody thought the large seeds were going to need more calcium. As it turned out, we found out that our current recommendations for the small seed had held for the large. So you think, well, we wasted our time. Well, not really. We confirmed the recommendations still hold. They can save the farmer some money. Made them feel a little better about the recommendations. And then the last thing on rate I wanted to mention, we're fortunate with cotton. You know, we talk about rate early on and set it, but you can make some in-season adjustments. And cotton, we can both use tissue testing before bloom and then petiole testing after. Tissue sampling early for things like micronutrients, sulfur, which you need to fix those early because they're harder to fix later on, especially with foliar. And then later on, we can take the petiole or leaf stem, and the focus is on fine-tuning nitrogen and potassium, usually using foliar applications. All right, so that was rate. Now let's move on to source. And like I said, I think a lot of times growers are bad about, tell me how much I need, I'll just go down the store, whatever you have, give it to me, put it on. Luckily, that works out a lot of times because we've worked out what works best in an area. But there can be a lot of choices of different fertilizers to use, and I get a lot of questions, well, which one's better, which one should I use in this situation? And really, when you think about it, there's a number of factors to look at. You got to have it available for purchase. You can have the best fertilizer in the world, but if you can't get it to your farm, it's no use to you. Nutrient availability would be the next one, and a lot of times that comes down to solubility. There's different fertilizer materials, and anytime you see a new one, and saw a number of papers here being presented on polyhalite. We actually tested that as a calcium source on peanut, compared it to our other current ones, and I'll get to that in a second. Leachability, where we are with sandy soils, about 52 inches of rain a year. I'm not even sure leachability is a real word. We're bad in the South, but we just make them up if we don't, just make up any word you want. But you get the idea. Main focus is nitrate leaching we worry about, although potassium will move. It doesn't move. A lot of people think it moves as much as nitrogen. It doesn't, but it does move. And, of course, phosphorus we're not that worried about. What about plant preference? We all know that plants, for example, nitrogen, they can take up both ammonium or nitrate. Do certain plants prefer one over the other? That's a good question. I'll show you some data on cotton where it might lead you to believe there is a plant preference for one over the other in cotton. And then, of course, cost. You always got to factor in cost. So let's take nitrogen, for example. You look at the ones available to us in South Georgia. They're very different. Anhydrous being a gas, of course. Liquid solutions, urea and ammonium nitrate. If you're going to use solids, it's going to be one of those two. And ammonium sulfate, we usually use more for a blended in for a sulfur source and a little nitrogen and a straight nitrogen source. In fact, data is getting a little old, but this trend probably still holds. This is nitrogen use in Georgia in 2010, reported to the Department of Ag. This is for all crops across the state, so it includes forages, hay and pasture, whatever. But we use very little anhydrous, and that makes sense because of our soil types. And I think with dealer cost and safety issues, ammonium sulfate is fairly low. Urea and ammonium nitrate, if you had gone back probably to the year 2000, they would have been flip-flopped. But by 2010, they kind of reversed with the issues with ammonium nitrate. But then look at the nitrogen solutions. We use a lot of liquid nitrogens on crops like cotton, corn, and even forages. In fact, and again, we're talking about source now, the main source of liquid nitrogen would be UAN or 32%. We do like to put sulfur in it for 28005, but I think a lot of growers really probably even haven't thought about this too much, but with the composition of that, it's about half urea and about a quarter of ammonium nitrate. It just so happens we actually have another liquid that we have. It's a byproduct. It's not very readily available even in other parts of the Southeast, called 19E. And it's 19%, and it's basically liquid ammonium nitrate and sodium nitrate. So it's about 60% nitrate, 40% ammonium, and no urea in it at all. And we add sulfur to it to make 18003. So it's a very different product. And again, a lot of people looked at that initially and said, oh, it's got too much nitrate, it's all going to leach. Again, our sandy soils with a lot of rain. And somebody came up to me not too long after I started looking at it, and they said, well, it's not that far from ammonium nitrate. Ammonium nitrate is about 50-50. This is 60-40. This actually turns out to be a pretty good product. I got accused of being a little biased, but not. The same company actually also can make a product. They thought, well, if that's the case, the three-way blend mix, it's like making a perfect loam. The three-way blend of ammonium nitrate and urea should be perfect, right? As it turns out, it does not do as good as some of the others. So it gets back to that issues of different sources. Urea, we worry about volatilization. Nitrate, we worry about leaching. And, is ammonium the best form? Or should you spread your risk? So just some data real quick to show you, again, how you test this and confirm things. This is an average of five locations back in 2010 and 11, just three different nitrogen rates on cotton, just using the 18003 versus the 28005. And actually, they're probably not statistical difference, but numerically, the 18 actually does a little better on average than the 28. Now, if you're a big grower, you got other considerations like carrying around more liquid with a 19 versus a 28 and that kind of thing. It's actually a byproduct, has some clay in it, so there's a learning curve on how not to clog filters, etc. But it is also cheaper per pound of N, the 19 is, versus the 28. So we're using a lot of it. I really expanded that even further, got a little carried away, been doing this for years now. This is actually 4 years worth of data, two locations, two different years. But what I wanted to show you this for is, if you look, these are trends. I don't like looking at 1 year data, one location, but you start doing enough of them, you start looking at trends, and I can put the stats on it. But if you look at the top, it's not a huge difference, but if it's about 200 pounds of lint and cotton, that's significant. And look what's on the top, ammonium nitrate, calcium ammonium nitrate, and 18, all things that are heavy in ammonium and nitrate. All right, what's on the bottom, things like urea and 32. So it gets a little tricky for me because I don't tell people don't use urea on cotton, but I'm not shy about telling them it's probably not my favorite. I'd probably go with ammonium nitrate over urea, and I'd probably go with one of the liquids if you can. And I think it's plant preference. It's hard to prove exactly, but the data like that gets some growers' attention. Because the other thing is you say, well, ammonium nitrate's more expensive, but if it consistently makes you more yield, maybe it pays for itself. And then it really got carried away with a foliar K-source. I'm not going to go through all this, but that's another thing. We're going to talk about foliar on replacement, but there's a ton of materials out there for foliar feeding cotton and really trying to sort them out. They basically come down to things like potassium nitrate, potassium acetate, potassium thiosulfate, and all kinds of versions of that. All right. Done boron, too. Boron's an interesting one, micronutrient. We have recommendations, half pound of boron on cotton and peanuts, just routine. We don't soil test for it, but we recommend that rate. It's important for pollination and fruiting. Over the years, I've tested a ton of different boron materials. Either got sodium borate, the old solubore, or all the liquids are derived from boric acid, but then they put different things in them to make them work a little better. I can tell you that boric acid by itself, in fact, straight out of the bag, works pretty darn good. And I just basically tell people as far as the source of boron, pound for pound, boron's boron, and base it on price. Now, liquids are more convenient to chunk in the tank, as we say, and time is money to a lot of our big growers, and that's fine. But pound for pound, I haven't seen any boron that's hit the shoulders above another one, and really haven't seen any dogs. Calcium on peanut, I'm going to finish up my talk talking about it, but we've just within gypsums alone, there's all different kinds of calcium sulfates. You got naturally mined products. You have byproducts of the phosphorus industry. You got byproducts of smokestack, FGD gypsum. We compare that to lime, et cetera. So we've done that research. And again, we'll stay with source. I mean, there's all kinds of things out there, especially when it comes to foliar. There's all kinds of this and that. There's these kind of products. I'm not real good at math, but I'm pretty sure that 3 times 0 is still 0. All right? So I'm not sure the advantage of triple strength in this product, personally. I even had this one sent to me. This is a real product, by the way. I was a little confused at first, but then if you read the fine print, anybody want to guess what this is designed for? It's actually designed for medical marijuana production. So I guess the skull and a candle should have been my clue that I missed. But anyway, real product, claims to make all this bigger roots and healthier plant and all this kind of thing. So anyway, I'm a little nervous to go to my next slide because these next ones, there's some that work. And there's some that don't in this thing, but where do we put additives? Okay, so we're talking rate, source, timing, and placement. You know, I'd put it in with source because you're trying to make sources work better, right? So, I started in 2006, I think, working with Agritane and done a lot of different products looking at these additives or efficiencies or stabilizers or whatever you want to call them. And at least there's some that we can, this urease, we at least got a quick and dirty method to screen them. I work with Miguel Cabrera, he's on our main campus, soil scientist, and I call it a bucket technology, high school chemistry level study, but it actually works really good to screen urease inhibitors. It's just a closed chamber technique with PVC pipe. You basically can put liquid, treated or untreated, with the urease inhibitors. You can even use treated or untreated granular urea. You got your acid trap in there. You put it in for 7 days, and then you pull it up afterwards and measure the ammonium in it. And the data looks like this, and we're so used to looking at the high bar winds. I mean, growers are always looking for the highest bar. But in this case, the low bar winds, like golf. Because if you look on the left, that's untreated urea, and you see the volatilization that happened. And then you see some products. At this point, they were thinking that humic acid might work. It didn't. But then you go over to the right-hand side, and things like Agritane and Arborite really reduced your volatilization, and you got a little bit of background check there. So we can check some of these sources and additives. All right, I think we're on track time-wise. We got 2 hours left. We have time and placement. And time is interesting. I mean, timing is everything, right? And it is true. A couple things I thought about, and knowing this audience was supposed to be spread out across the country, and my experience in North versus South is fall and spring applications. And I'm not trying to start another civil war here. I'm just saying that it's a big difference between North and South. We do not fall apply NP and K where we are. But you think about it, you know, we don't freeze over the wintertime. And if it was just phosphorus, we could do it, right? It's fairly mobile. But if we put nitrogen out now in November and don't grow a crop and grow cotton in May, that nitrogen will be gone. So it's just a waste of time and money. So you know that timing can be extremely important. Because we're so sandy and get a lot of rainfall, we use a lot of split applications. A lot of other parts of the country and world won't need to do that. But we routinely split nitrogen on corn and cotton. And with it's not only leaching on cotton, it also has to do with plant physiology and balancing vegetative and reproductive growth. And then I get tons of questions all the time on when's it too late or too early to do things fertilization-wise, especially with foliars. And I think a lot of our foliars, for example, on cotton go way out too late. Some on corn go out too early. They hardly even have any leaf area to spray it with, and they're trying to foliar feed corn. But you try to meet nutrient demand, and then, you know, some things like sulfur and micronutrients, I want to treat with soil applied early, especially sulfur. Micronutrients actually foliar feed well, but we still want to probably go earlier in the life cycle of things like cotton, peanuts, if you have a problem. Nitrogen on cotton, actually the best timing is a three-way split. And our recommendation is to put a quarter to a third of the nitrogen on at planting, and the rest either at side dress or between side dress and foliar. And foliar we can do both ways. We can do it with ground rigs or we can do it with airplanes. And it is, I didn't put that data set in here, but we have tested this, and it is the most efficient way and best way to feed nitrogen to a cotton plant. I even did early, all at planting, all at side dress, or the three-way split. And obviously the three-way split works the best. Corn, in a cotton you don't want to split it up too much, but corn, you know, we can split up and spoon feed. We have recommendations for fertigation to have split it up, so that's definitely a timing issue. I still don't like to go out too late. I think a lot of our growers got carried away and feeding corn really late. This is a true story. I had a grower call me one time and said, you know, I'm thinking about putting some nitrogen on my corn. I said, well, what stage is it? He says, well, I'm going to harvest it next week. And I'm thinking, I think you're probably missed your opportunity a little there. I don't mind around tasseling even, but you get, you know, silks turn brown. I really think we're done. And some of that came out. There was a lot of press about how much nutrients corn takes up after tasseling. But so they assumed in their mind that means you had to keep fertilizing it after tasseling, which is two different things. Anyway, we have those recommendations. K timing on both corn and cotton, I've done. A lot of people say, hey, if we split nitrogen, we ought to split potassium, right? All my data shows that you really don't get a lot of advantage of splitting potash on cotton or corn in the southeast on the coastal plain soil. All right, the last one is placement, or the right place, like real estate, location, location, location. Some of the things that came to mind were broadcast versus banding. And it's different whether you're talking P and K banding versus nitrogen. We band a lot of nitrogen, P and K not as much. How close to the row with a band? I haven't done that research yet myself, but I think it'd be interesting to do. You know, how close do I need to be next to the corn row or the cotton row when I side dress to get? There might be some differences. Deep placement. We don't deep place in the southeast, but I know there are other soils across the country that. Especially ones with K fixation, that might be an advantage, but it's not an advantage to us. And starter fertilizers, I think, are a special case of banding. The traditional recommendation is a 2x2, but we had a lot of interest in recent years about putting fertilizers in the furrow. And then also, I use what we call a 2x0. Our soils are so sandy that we can go 2 inches to the side, dribbled on the surface, and with some even, you know, 1034-0, that phosphorus will get far enough down there to be taken up. So. This is one I really thought was interesting, though, and again, this is where the 4Rs and especially placement comes in into play. You had some companies out there saying, band your P&K on corn and cotton, and you can reduce your rates in half. And what they would tell you is they would tell you, okay, I'm going to go with the full rate of broad that's on broadcast that's on the left, in the half rate band and you come about the same, so it works, right? But what's the problem with that experiment? You don't have all the necessary treatments. And what you really need to do is look at the full rate broadcast and banded and the half rate, full rate broad or banded and half rate, and what you find out is really didn't matter. So it's a great way to sell a product to band P&K, but in reality, I really don't see an advantage of banding on our types of soils. Again, on other soils, it might work, but in our situation, it does not. Starters, that one got kind of interesting. This is a busy slide, but basically what you have is you have, for example, no starter, but then you got 10-30-4-0 in furrow or 2x0, and then you have it with 28, and you have nitrogen only, nitrogen, potassium, and then the last treatment is everything, 10-30-4-0 to 28 and micros. And I did this the first year, and I reduced my rates really low not to kill the corn. And, you know, reduced it so low, didn't see a lot of response. And somebody says, well, you should have had your higher rates and showed it killed it. I'm like, okay, I can do that. So that's what we did, and it's not a good picture. It's an old cell phone picture, but you get the idea. That center treatment, you put too much stuff in the furrow on our soils on corn, you're going to reduce your stand pretty dramatically. So that's a placement issue all around. In fact, so to shape the extension recommendation on our four summer row crops, you know, corn, yes, but we got recommendations. I did not see a response to K, and I really don't like them in the furrow. I think we can do a better job with higher rates in the 2x2 or 2x0. Cotton is not as hardy, so you can't get away with as much. So we ratchet that down to just a 10-30-4-0. And then peanuts don't really need it. And soybean, maybe for a late soybean planted to get some height on it. I'm going to skip this slide and wrap up with this one. I don't know how I'm doing on time. Maybe we'll have time for questions. But if you don't work with peanuts are really interesting. And, you know, they fix nitrogen. They're good scavengers of P and K. Really, the fertilizer issue on peanuts comes down to calcium. And the reason is because a peanut plant can't take up calcium from the soil into the plant and put it back into the nut. Due to various reasons, it doesn't translocate. So you have to have calcium in the pegging zone, the top 3 inches of the soil where those peanuts are pegging down, and it gets absorbed directly through the hull into the developing nut. If you don't have calcium, you get pops or no nut, which reduces yield. You can get pod rot, black heart, and poor germination. We actually grow, unlike cotton, we grow our own peanut seed. We contract grow it, and there's a direct relationship. This is some data that I generated myself. There had been some old data on old varieties, but basically the higher calcium level in the nut itself, the better germination, and there's a break-off point there. I can tell you the peanut seed companies were extremely interested in this data when it first came out, because we were recommended you were okay down around 250 part per million. Well, if you look at this graph, that's not true. You want to probably be up more around 500 to hedge your bets and have good germination. But it's interesting that this gets all wrapped around with all four R's, because we can try to rely on the soil test calcium. We can use lime or calcium carbonate. We can use gypsum, calcium sulfate, and we can even use some clear liquids and put them through the pivot, calcium thiosulfate, calcium chloride. But how we do those, it really depends on the solubility of the product and timing, et cetera, and placement. So lime, we put at planting because it's not as soluble. Gypsum at bloom time, we can put it on later because it's more soluble. The calcium thiosulfates and chlorides, they're really soluble, so we can wait till peak pod fill, about 60, 90 days after planting, and put them through pivot. And we also found out that, and it makes sense, gypsum is more important in dry land than it is irrigated. Most people think, oh, my high yield in irrigated land, that's where I need to put my gypsum. But you got the pivot sitting there in the water to dissolve the soil test calcium, so you should hedge your bets on getting calcium in the nut. Whereas dry land, limited rainfall, you better have a source out there that's fairly soluble that can get into the nut. So this is what it ends up looking like, the right source. You know, you're going to use gypsum, and there's all different kinds of gypsum. There's all different kinds of limes, really. Dolomitic, calcitic, regular ground, fine lime. We even have liquid limes we're looking at. Calcium chloride, like I said, and foliar does not work. Again, calcium does not translocate. And there are people that sell foliar calciums on peanut. And I tell the growers, you know, just don't waste your time. Rate, if you're using gypsum, we're up in the 1,000 to 1,500 pound range. Lime, we usually go around a ton per acre. Calcium chlorides are very available, so you can back that down to about 20 gallons per acre or so. And again, foliar, just say no. And then timing, again, because of the solubility, lime at planting, gypsum early bloom, the other's peak pod fill. And then placement, you know, you broadcast, calcium chloride goes to the pivot, it's really broadcast, and foliar doesn't work. So that's kind of a good example of how all four R's come into play when we're looking at a specific fertilization, one nutrient on one crop. We do have a teaching program that we teach in. We like to show that every talk we give, and also come to Georgia and we can go hike the little Grand Canyon. If you want to see severe gully erosion, that looks pretty. It's kind of weird. Come see that. And then we'll just keep you away from areas like this. You do not want to be around that area. That's a lightning strike in the middle of a cotton field. It happens all the time. So with that, I don't know if I have time for questions, but I'll finish. Went through that kind of quick, but I was hoping to either have questions or go to lunch early, beat the lunch crowd.